Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. There's a big difference between a solution that measures a fundraiser's performance and a solution that helps a fundraiser perform. QBAC helps fundraisers to excel at their most critical task, developing deep, meaningful relationships with donors and cultivating them into lifelong givers. Give your fundraisers a better qualified portfolio, one that considers more than just capacity and simple scoring. Your fundraisers will also get insights into the hearts, minds, and connections of their donors. Fundraisers have a tough job. Help them close bigger gifts in less time by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. Podcast listeners, the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow is finally back on the schedule. We have several dates confirmed. Since 2014, our team has been providing high-quality one-day roadshows in partnership with nonprofit leaders who want to showcase their space and provide thought-provoking and highly interactive fundraising training in their nonprofit community. Our roadshows have been described by our guest as hands down the best professional development experience that they have ever been a part of. This experience has been described as challenging assumptions with conversation-inspiring content and new ways of thinking. If you would like to register for one of the upcoming stops on the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow, just visit the link in the show notes. Hi, guys. I am delighted to have you today as my guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Sam, you're a repeat guest. I think this actually might be conversation number three. You're always good for some intellectually stimulating conversation. I think you were probably part of the original 25. I don't know. And you and I have yet to this day enjoyed a cup of coffee in person, but somehow or another we've managed to allow podcasting and social media to develop a friendship. I think we follow each other's families as they've grown up over the last couple of years on Facebook. So I feel like I've spent my entire life with you, Sam. So I'm delighted to have you here. And then David, you're a new voice and a new contact. So I'm delighted to have you here as well. I look forward to getting to know you. Before we dive into our conversation, all of our guests know that we dive into a big idea, bold opinion. And we let the conversation emerge from there. But before we do that, how about we just ask you to introduce yourself? Sam, we'll start with you.
Thanks, Jason. It's nice to be back. My name is Sam Butler, and I am the head of public fundraising at Starlight Children's Foundation and a founding member of the Chartered Institute of Fundraising's Supporter Interest Group.
And David, tell us who you are.
Hi, Jason. First of all, thank you for inviting me into the fold. This is my first podcast, so we're delighted to be part of such a great one as well. So I'm David Amos Reeves. I work with Sam at Starlight as Head of Business Intelligence and IT, and I'm also the Chair of the Chartered Institute of Fundraising Supporter Experience Group. And I'm particularly interested in leadership and the role that it plays in our world.
You know what, Sam? We have had you here on the podcast a couple of times. I'm familiar with Starlight and what you all do, but I don't know in our previous conversations if I've ever asked you. And since we've got both two of you on the show today, why don't you just one of you, tell us about the organization a little bit before we dive into our topic?
So, Starlight was founded about 35 years ago. It was traditionally seen as a wish charity in terms of granting seriously ill children wishes. And in the sort of post-pandemic world, we pivoted towards kind of providing play and distraction aids for children spending time in hospital and hospices across the UK, and offering them and their families breaks through organised days and trips away. So coupled with that, we've had a rebrand, we've grown in terms of team and expertise, we've got an exciting strategy, and a perfect storm ahead of us in terms of the economic climate, the political climate. I would say probably not felt as anxious about a sort of a financial year ahead of us as I did when the crash hit us in 2006, 2007. So that's Starlight. David has been brought in to work with the organisation, but sort of picked up with me almost immediately, just in terms of ensuring that we're basing a lot of our decisions on insight rather than gut instinct.
And David, again, before we dive into our topic, you and Sam are also a member of, can you tell us a little bit about the involvement that you all have together with the, and I don't want to put the word, I don't want to label it the wrong way. So tell us a little bit about
it. Sure. So we are, we're voluntary actually. So we're voluntary members of the Chartered Institute of Fundraising. That's our professional body in the UK for fundraising. And I think they kind of stretch worldwide in many ways, but our focus is very much in the UK. And our group of the committee, there's probably about 15 of us, we're very much focused on all the things that make up delivering a great supporter experience. So, and it's everything from influencing strategy and how people behave through to managing how your communications go out the door to talking about how you use data to personalize things for supporters and really get the deliver a great experience for donors so that they stay with you and continue to deliver impact over a number of years. So that's what we're about as a group. We're about giving back to the sector. And hopefully upskilling everybody in that field.
Yeah, well, guys, here's a little backstory on the reason when Sam reached out and said, "Hey, we want to have a conversation with you, and I want to introduce you to one of my colleagues, David." Sam, I think you introduced me to Nikki Bell. I've had her on here a couple of times. She's with Fundraising Everywhere. We had Martha was on here, six, 9 months ago with myself and another member of our colleague before the summer conference. And there might even be another individual or two in the mix. I think you reached out to Ken Burnett at one point because we right before the pandemic, you said, "Hey, Ken, why don't you talk to that guy in the U.S.?" I've been very grateful for some of the connections that you've made with our fundraising colleagues in the UK. Guys, we ask our guests to come on here with a big idea, bold opinion. We don't always know what it is. We don't know where it's going to go, but we use it always. It has yet to fail us. So what do you got for us today?
Go on, Sam, you take this one.
Sam's a regular. He knows how to put it out there.
Well, I wanted to talk about leadership from an incredibly kind of global perspective in terms of thought leaders, organizations that influence the way that we fundraise, and the fact that we've sort of seen a sort of homogenized version of fundraising develop over the last sort of 15, 20 years based on the industry that's been built up around serving the sector, specifically in the UK. But I know that, you know, in terms of trends, the UK is often looked at as a global kind of signifier of where the industry's heading and what people should be doing. I think my concern is that they continue to do the same things we did in the same way and make the same mistakes along the way, rather than understanding the insights we've all been able to gather through evaluating those programs with a wealth of data. You know, if we're talking about 20, 25 years worth of data, particularly when it comes to acquisition. And I guess that's why I joined the Supporter Experience Group initially when it was a commission led by Ken Burnett. And like everything in my life, I feel I learn best by working shoulder to shoulder with others who have a deeper understanding of how we can utilize data and insights. And that's very much how David and I have kind of developed our friendship over the last sort of 3 to 4 years.
And maybe, David, I know you guys have talked a little bit about this. Maybe you can further qualify what we mean by this notion of homogenized, because that can mean a number of things, especially in the context of fundraising. And, you know, it can mean a lot of things. Tell us, unravel that a little bit more for our friend Sam.
Sure. I think, homogenized was very much a word that Sam used. But I think, you know, from a granular level, looking at the supporter experience, we quite often as a charity sector will treat, a mass of individuals as one kind of homogenous group and think yeah. that, you know, the same thing can apply to those, you might find a quirk in the data and apply it across the whole lot, making a huge assumption about it. I also think there's similar kind of principles existed within leadership. You know, we think of what a good business looks like based on the Industrial Revolution from 100 years ago. It was all about mechanics and industry. And we structure our organizations in a very homogenous way as, you know, these hierarchical things. And that principle shared across most charities and most organizations in the charity sector. And you see very much the private sector trying to break away from that now with quite innovative ways of doing it. So I think there's a lot of places where kind of the charity sector is homogenized and that causes us challenges in the sense that we can't relate to people on a one-to-one level that we need to be able to relate to them to deliver the impact that we need to be able to deliver. And maybe even the same happens with our beneficiaries as well, where we assume the same challenges that exist within our beneficiaries and we try and treat them with one simple solution, and it might not always be as easy as that.
Yeah, I think I'm reminded of, Sam, I'm trying to recall exactly what the theme was for the earliest conversation that you and I had. But when we think about anytime you see a homogenized sort of system, you see a very robust system, but you also see extraordinary levels of efficiency. And I just sort of wonder if that's what, I've been wrestling with as I've been working on a particular project the last couple of years. I've been wrestling with this question of efficiency. You and I may have even talked about this. We've sort of let, and David, you're referencing the Industrial Revolution. I mean, that's when efficiency sort of became the cardinal virtue that we, even to this day, we don't know how to even contemplate the idea that efficiency could be a bad word. But the more homogenized your system is, the more efficient it tends to be.
And is that a trade-off though, Jason, between,
yes.
Increase your efficiency, reduce your effectiveness in some ways? And, that's an interesting kind of avenue to explore, I reckon.
Well, and I don't want to hijack your conversations, but I'm just sort of I want you guys to sort of know where I'm at in terms of my own reading and my own research as it relates to the topic that we're having. But, I've been researching what are called robust yet fragile systems. And I think about the fragility, the challenges that we keep running into in our sector and in our professional community, just within the context of fundraising. And I think, every couple of years, every 12 to 18 months, we're being sort of some additional type of fragile sort of characteristic that could perhaps just sort of push us over the edge seems to be exposed, and some of this dates back to the stuff that played out for you all in 2015, the donor dominance conversation that played out I think in 2018, 2019. Then everything that played out around the pandemic and with the George Floyd murder here in the U.S., that sort of stirred up a number of conversations. We're talking about some pretty, but homogenization is at the core of a lot of those conversations. Am I right?
Yes, I think you are. rather than us both sat here nodding on a podcast. I think that the main thing for me is that the the technology that we have access to and the skills that we require in terms of staff and resources in managing that technology and learning from it is finite in our sector. I don't think we have a wealth of it. I think a lot of people have, you know, attempted to move to a more kind of digital fundraising program, especially in public fundraising, which is where I sit. But I think you've seen some success across, you know, sort of virtual gala balls, that sort of that special event kind of area over the past. I think the biggest problem is that we still operate in quite a transactional way when we're coming to kind of acquisition and huge levels of it. And I don't think that we take an approach where we're wanting to learn more about those individuals that are supporting us, or as David touched on, potentially using our services as well. I know that you know that I'm a big Springsteen fan, but I think he is a great example of somebody that's had an ongoing conversation with his audience over a very long period of time. And he almost kind of acts as somebody who's serving at the behest of the imagination of his audience. And I don't think that we do that as fundraisers. I think we try and force people into a particular product or into a particular kind of method or pipeline of giving without a true understanding of their motivation to give. And, you know, part of the work that I'm undertaking with David is to kind of resegment and re-understand who is in our database and what their motivation has been in terms of engaging with us over the past. And when we're going out to a new audience, again, understanding what it is about us that's motivated them to give. And I think part of the change in charities over the last maybe sort of 10 years is all around the kind of political angle that a lot of charities have seen, I think, dwindle. I think you see much more activism from small sort of community groups rather than people being able to align their set of values with a real sense of understanding the values of that organization they're joining and supporting. And I think that's a shame. I think it's disempowering for organizations that should be lobbying the government and standing up for their particular area of rights. You know, I'm excited in terms of where I am in my career and the organization that I work for, the culture that we have, the opportunities that that's providing to us in a world that feels quite bereft of opportunities at the moment for fundraisers. But I think a lot of it is about leadership. And I think that's where the conversation should probably shift over to David to kind of give his thoughts on how that is impacting on the supporter experience.
Yeah, I actually want to go back slightly and I'll come back to leadership. And this concept of robust and, you know, as a sector, we've gone through many of those challenges, Jason, that you mentioned earlier, and have come out, you know, still clean the other side, relatively clean the other side, which is really, you know, it's a really great place to be. And it's made me think, you know, we've been the fastest growing sector in the UK for the last decade, as far as I can tell. And it's despite all of these things that we're not doing, in my view, particularly well, you know, this connection to cause and as Sam sort of alluded to, actually being brave about our values and what we're here to do, because there are a lot of charities, particularly the bigger ones, that are playing it a bit safer than they perhaps might have done, you know, a decade or two decades ago. And I think, you know, when you think about the political and social environment at the moment, that actually in some ways helps that robustness, because there's more awareness in society that, you know, politics aren't perhaps as being, you know, parliament, the government perhaps aren't as being as helpful as they could be to, you know, the beneficiaries that we're trying to support. But my feeling is that that allows space for complacency, that allows, you know, the leadership within the charity sector to go, actually, let's blame government, let's blame this, let's blame that. We need your help because the financial situation, the economy is screwing us over, and we need your help. Actually, there's a bit about, you know, is it more about those leaders being self-aware, being so connected to their values, so connected to their impact, and working in partnership with their donors and their beneficiaries at a more meaningful level that actually allows that robustness, that sustainability to be so much stronger than it currently is. And actually, you know, if we were doing this 10 years ago, would we have ridden through COVID and, you know, the financial crash and the challenges around the Olive Cook, you know, back in 2015, yes, around kind of the relationship with donors, you know, would we have ridden through that much cleaner and much easier, and therefore having much less pressure from the press around everything that we do? You know, we're constantly being speculated about, we're constantly being under the microscope. So there's a thing for me about, you know, the role that, that leadership in the sector plays here. And if we took a less, you know, transactional, a less industrious view over what we do as an organization, you know, collectively, would that give us a, you know, a much more stable platform for us to be able to make better impacts or more meaningful impacts in society?
You know, David, I've got a presentation coming up where I'm talking about sort of these five themes. So this is broadcast. This conversation is probably broadcasting it somewhere around number 350 or something. It's been a lot of conversations, as we said. Sam's been a part of them. And in light of everything you just said, David, I'm interested in your thoughts on one of these themes, because this is perhaps, and this is using one of the words that you just used, Sam. But part of what I think I'm picking up on when I sort of try to discern sort of in between the lines of all these conversations is an evolution of the fundraising's job description towards something that looks more like a persuasive activist. And I don't know how to do that at scale. And I don't know how to do that sort of through the lens of, say, mass marketing and everything that we talk, you know, with direct response. And how do we do that on, you know, these, you know, on these grand systems that can do things? When we think of activism, we think of it more boots on the ground and in the streets and that kind of stuff. But David, in light of what you all sort of, what you guys came here to talk about this morning, what's your response to that, that the job of the fundraiser could be evolving, that we're sort of, this next generation of fundraisers is sort of rising up in a myriad of contexts, working for any number of organizations? But is that what we're talking about, that we're going to be, you know, persuasive activists?
Yeah,
trying to figure out how to persuade rather than being sort of highly overly responsive to the preferences of our donors. We're going to try to persuade them to go in the direct, you know, in some brave and bold sort of directions. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, you think of the word fundraising, and it comes with some preconceptions. It comes with, you know, people expecting there to be a transaction there or some sort of money being given over to somebody. And sometimes that comes with no exchange of value, and sometimes you do. I think what I see already in the UK charity sector in particular is lots of organizations are dropping the word fundraiser, and they're using engagement or experience or, you know, you see much more kind of relationship based words in there, and I think you're right. I think moving towards kind of much more bolder, more interesting job titles might actually change the perspective of the roles in the sector. Activism, you know, persuasive activism may be too strong a word for some organizations. I don't know,
I like it, but I'm not on anybody's payrolls.
Well, yeah, no, that's true. But I think, you know, I think it's all about the perception of the people on the receiving end of that role or that job title.
Right.
You know, we all have a job here to persuade people in society to make a difference to, you know, a problem that we have. You know, that's an element of it. Do we need to be so bold about it? You know, does somebody want to be persuaded? I don't think anyone really wants to be persuaded. If you ask somebody if they were being persuaded, they probably wouldn't know they were.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a strong, bold job title. I think it's the direction we're going in. But we definitely need to move away from this preconception that we have around fundraising, I think.
So David, I've studied, and Sam can appreciate this, because I like to pat myself on the back periodically as being one of the first Americans who tried to unravel the Olive Cook tragedy and sort of bring it to light for a lot of us Americans. And through the lens of that, David and Sam, you can certainly comment on this as well, but I'm interested, you know, one of my critiques of that whole sort of, one of the ways I think we are missing the point, and if I'm thinking about the fundraiser who would have been this persuasive activist, I'm thinking of that fundraiser who would have figured out how to land in Olive's living room and persuade her not to give to the other, you know, there were 99 charities on her, you know, dining room table. And who was going to be that brave fundraiser who was going to sit in her living room and persuade her not to give to the other 98, right? I mean, that in some ways, I think, was some of the flaw in that that sort of came to head and was sort of made aware to all of us, is there was just too many damn charities on her dining room table. And had somebody persuaded her, look, stop giving to 99 charities and just give to a half a dozen of them, it will make for a much more meaningful experience for you. And you'll make even with your small contributions, it will have much more, you know, it'll go further. Does that make sense, David?
It does. I would disagree. I don't think it's on us to decide who and how many charities someone should give to. They say the average at the moment is somewhere between 3 and 5, and it's dropped per person. But if someone wants to give to 100 charities, that's up to them, I think. But we have a responsibility of understanding what our impact on that person's life is. So, you know, if we are, as an organization, sending hundreds of communications out per year and ignoring the fact that those communications are not being responded to, not engaged with, perhaps not even wanted, that's the kind of dialogue we need to be having with our supporters is, yes, let's spark up this relationship where you provide us with funding, we go and make an impact on your behalf, and we share that impact with you. But let's have a conversation about how you want that to work. So, you know, if you only want one communication a year, what does that look like? What's the thing that's going to give you the most value in that relationship as a supporter?
David, I would bake what I think is baked into your argument, though. That idea that 99 charities belong on anybody's dining room table, I think low expectations are baked into that. And so how do we persuade more donors to give to fewer organizations and have high, and both sides of the relationship have higher expectations? If Olive had higher expectations of the people she was supporting, and the people she was supporting had higher expectations of the levels of support, we might have remedied that without having to make a judgment on how many charities are on our table. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's got to be, it's got to be within someone's understanding of impact. You know, I could give £1 to 99 charities, and I could, it's a bit like spread betting, you know, I could spread my £99 across lots of charities.
Yes.
And have a tiny impact individually on those charities. I could give £99 to Starlight and potentially fund a box that goes out to a child and changes their day, you know, what do I want as a donor? I want to know that my money is making the most difference. And if those charities aren't communicating that effectively and they're not saying that my pound is making a difference, then it's up to me to change where my donation goes or how I choose to invest that money.
Right, and you're sort of deconstructing what part of my argument is. Is it part of Starlight's obligation and responsibility to communicate that? Is that Sam's job to find those donors who are giving £1 and help them make sense of the fact that if they give 99, it'll benefit both sides of the relationship in far more meaningful and significant ways?
I think, you know, it's a simplistic view. Yes, I think that would be the ideal situation. However, the reality is if you go to somebody with an uplift ask from, you know, £1 to £99, the chances are they're not going to give you the pound. So it is about that dialogue. It is about understanding the context of every individual. Some people might prefer to give a pound to lots of charities. Right. And actually, if the whole of society gave a pound to 99 charities, the net effect is still the same. You know, every charity will get the billions that they need to be able to do, you know, every charity sector will get the billions they need to be able to do their work. It's just coming from 99 places, right? You know, 99 individual donations rather than one person giving 99 pounds.
And Sam, I think you've picked up on this. We've got to get you in here because you've been listening quietly for a few minutes as me and David have gotten warmed up. Sam, you've heard me talking about, as others have, this difference between sort of moving from a donor as consumer to a donor as citizen. And what I hear, when I hear David describing a donor who has every right to give to 99 charities, I'm hearing a donor who's behaving like a consumer. And when I hear a donor who can be persuaded to give to that one charity where he or she is having a far more meaningful experience and making a far greater impact, I'm hearing a donor who is maturing from a consumer to that of a citizen. Does that make sense, Sam?
Yeah, it does. I think that there's a fundamental issue, and I've said this before on a podcast, in terms of the level of duplication that exists within our own sector. You know, we're talking about there being 160,000 registered charities in the UK.
Yeah.
I'm taking this back to the conversation around leadership. I think that there needs to be a kind of a public review audit of the sector. I think that people's motivations to give are so complex, and, you know, we try and simplify them in order for them to work for us through the channels and means we have to fundraise.
Yeah.
But I also think that, you know, the regulators and the policymakers around the sector need to take a step back and look at, one, the monopolization of the sector, particularly through partnering with bigger agencies that do a lot of third-party fundraising on their behalf, and the access that gives them above and beyond most other organizations with a charitable cause. I think that the duplication of particular types of causes or themes, there needs to be a much stronger sense of trying to encourage organizations to merge, to kind of reduce that level of duplication that we see in the UK, and giving donors really firm kind of decisions on what they might deem a kind of a local cause or a local activist group that they want to support and get behind, and then sort of the national bodies or the international bodies that they want to get behind as well. I think when you look at the kind of infrastructure of some of the organizations that sit in the top 200, 300 charities in the UK, their overheads are absolutely huge in terms of their running costs. And I think where you see real success in terms of something like the rollout of the vaccination program in the UK, you saw a huge amount of those very well-established voluntary organizations coming together to deliver something that really worked. I'd like to see more of that. I'd like to see more of that happen just under normal circumstances, so that we are having the biggest impact we possibly can as a sector, rather than having this sense of self-preservation setting in at board, trustee, senior management level, which is all about how do we continue to replicate what we've been doing for the last 100 or so years, mm-hmm. as well as all these other organizations that are almost doing the same thing as us.
Right. Can you guys clarify, as we sort of take a turn in that we're about a half hour in and we've got a good 20 minutes yet to go, can you clarify, when you use the word leadership, sometimes in the sector and in these conversations with fundraisers, that sounds very generic and sort of broad. Who are the leaders we're talking about? Because, I mean, here we are, three fundraisers who generally are typically, you know, we're not at the top of the org chart necessarily. We're not sitting on the boards of these organizations. Who are the leaders we're talking about that when you say leadership, who are we talking about?
I would say kind of established bodies. You know, the Chartered Institute of Fundraising, of which David and I are members and volunteer for. And, you know, in particular, I have questioned that in terms of the last sort of 2-3 years of my membership with them. I'm a firm believer on trying to make that change by working in partnership with people. And yeah. I completely respect that there's lots of people who don't see change happening through that route, that they want to act against it, and that they're more militant in the way that they display that and question that leadership body. We've got the Charity Commission. We have a government member of parliament who, I think it's the Minister for Culture and Sport, who represents charities at government level. I would say there's a huge, you know, there's probably a huge number of political individuals and professionals that sit on charity boards. You know, you only need to look at the list of knights of the realm and lords who sit on sort of charity bodies and boards. I think we just need to be really... the pandemic offered a transformational moment, I think, from a very practical level of fundraising. I think there needs to be a transformational movement kicked off around the governance. And I think that's, you know, charities are struggling. Part of the reason that we're struggling is that I think some members of the public question our relevance. I think when you see movements like Black Lives Matter start to spring up, you know, the grassroots level, activists around sort of environmental change and the sort of the movements we've seen spring up, particularly over the last sort of 5-6 years, that are, you know, they're disruptors. And I think that charities need to kind of stand back a little bit and start thinking, well, how do we fit into this? What's that new environment about? How can we structure ourselves to support those that need our help and the planet? You know, I think in terms of the biggest problem we face as a global society is the environment, you know. And I think bodies like COP that are currently meeting, the sort of level of cynicism that is aimed at that in terms of individuals with vested interests in maintaining the status quo or ensuring that their finger is firmly placed in the pie that becomes the next way in which we generate our energy and protect the environment. I think there needs to be less self-interest involved in that entire structure and system.
David, I'm interested in your reflection on what Sam just said as it relates. So I would be of the opinion that thinking about what Sam just said, you know, when I think of organizations like Black Lives Matter, I've also been following pretty closely Extinction Rebellion. I've been reading a book about sort of what's been playing out in the UK with that organization for the last couple of years. That predates the pandemic. I don't know if some of these organizations that are sort of rising up, I don't know if they give a damn how contemporary fundraising does what we do. I don't think they take us very seriously. Does that make sense? I don't think the group at Extinction Rebellion would look at a three guys like us and look at the way that we sort of toe the status quo and go to conferences, you know, and basically whatever is done in the, you know, whatever is peddled in the trade show hall, we're all going to basically do. I don't think these people take us seriously enough. And perhaps that requires a certain degree of self-reflection on our part. We need to sort of turn the mirror around and look at ourselves and ask ourselves some harder questions. Am I right?
Completely agree. I think, you know, you look at Extinction Rebellion, they're so driven by purpose. It's purpose that determines how they go about doing what they do. And, you know, they don't have to think about fitting into these hierarchical structures and these, you know, beliefs around leadership and mm-hmm. et cetera. And I think, you know, thinking back to what Sam was saying about, you know, leadership in the sector, about our governing bodies and our trustee boards, when you look at them, they're the same. You know, they're made up the same. They're people who have worked in industry for 30, 40, 50 years and have carried those beliefs into an entirely new fundraising context. Like, it's incredible. Like, the society couldn't be much different today than it was 5 years ago, never mind 30, 40, 50 years ago when these people were building their beliefs around the world. And so, you know, organizations like Extinction Rebellion, people who are agitators and change makers within the sector that might not have a director title or a trustee title or a CEO title, you know, they are leaders too. You know, they're people that should be striving for change and should be, challenging the sector to be better, and also challenging those leaders at the top to go, actually, it's time, you know, I've been here for 20 years, things have changed, it's about time I stepped aside, because something else needs to happen. And I think we as leaders, anyone who is in a leadership role, one of the probably best talents and skills that they could ever have is to recognize when it's time to step aside. And quite often you don't see that. And you know, I've been in charities where directors have been there for 2 decades in the same role. And I've had CEOs that have been in the same role for 2 decades and trustees that have been on the board for, you know, it's probably longer than I've been alive. And it just makes me think, you know, even me in my role now, I've only been in this role for 6 months at Starlight, you know, in 2 years, I may be out of fashion, you know, and that's the reality of it. You know, I have a responsibility to Starlight to be able to go, it's someone else's turn now. I'm better placed doing something else somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that's not going to be in 2 years, but, you know, it's that kind of self-awareness that I think leadership, including the governing bodies, need to have. You know, they need to have that maturity of thought and thought leadership to go, we need something else. And all of the signs in the sector are there for that to happen.
David, I don't know. And I think that brings us back to the, you know, the donor experience conversation, et cetera, is the idea, because a lot of what I've been looking at since the pandemic, you know, we're seeing 3 trends that I suspect you're seeing in the United Kingdom, similar to certainly what we're seeing here in the US. You know, we're seeing 3 trends amongst donor behavior, and that I sort of consistently pull together, and that is giving circles, direct giving, and mutual aid. You know, these to me seem like a donor behavior where the donor is saying, I'm not satisfied with the way that the traditional charity is going about the work that they do. I'm not satisfied with the experience that they afford me. And just like Extinction Rebellion or Black Lives Matter might be saying, you know, the traditional way of being a charity and bringing about positive change, the donor is sort of on the other side of the gift exchange and kind of saying the same thing. You follow me?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, gone are the days of the afternoon teas where you would, you know, generate a couple of grand and hand over and do a nice little check presentation.
Right, right.
You know, society is in that way. And you think about, I hate the terminology around Gen Z and Gen X, but, you know, the younger people of today have a very different way of engaging with the world and understanding the world, and have a very different way that they want to have an impact. And that isn't necessarily by giving someone a tenner and going, great. You know, it might be about active involvement. It might be, you know, doing something like Extinction Rebellion and being on the front line, literally. Or it might be through crowdfunding, or it might be through, you know, there's an awful lot of private organizations out there that are now starting to capitalize on the concept of charity and impact and, you know, such like within their model, within their business model. So, you know, are they stealing our charity consumers, if you want to call them that, you know, our donors, our supporters, because what they're able to do is buy the thing that they need to buy, and also do good for the environment, or do, you know, do good for society in another way. And my mind goes straight to, you know, the toilet roll company. Who gives a crap? You know, they are absolutely about that. They've got their customer experience nailed. They've got a great purpose. They're incredibly relevant at the moment, and especially during COVID, where in the UK, for some reason, we panic bought toilet roll. I don't know whether that was a worldwide thing or not. But, you know, I imagine their sales shot through the roof because it was just something that people needed. And you can feel good about consumerism as well at the same time. And with that combined with the cost of living crisis and your expendable income is shrinking, you know, are people actually thinking that it might be better investing in something that they're already buying that's doing something purposeful rather than doing that purchase and then doing something purposeful second to it? So there's lots of things that are changing, I think, in the way that people give.
See, it occurs to me as I'm listening to one of the benefits of these conversations is you maybe get these aha moments. But I'm thinking that the homogenization that sort of happens within our sector and within the fundraising community is perhaps because it happens at the transaction level, right? It's a very homogenized sort of way of experience. The donor experience, the donor themselves sort of looks all the same. Everything sort of comes through the same sort of channels. You know, even the process by which we make those decisions comes through. It just, everything's sort of the same. But I almost wonder if we were looking at, for if we were looking for similarities, I think about the response to the Ukraine. I think about a recent event that happened here in the U.S. when the University of Tennessee, when Tennessee beat Alabama, there was a moment of solidarity. It was what it was. There was this, the goalposts were taken down, and there was a fundraising event that happened subsequently thereafter. And it very much reminded me of the same response that we saw right after the breakout of the conflict in the Ukraine, where people were giving via Airbnb in order to put money into the Ukraine to help people in Ukraine. And it was just solidarity. It was the idea that we wanted to be in solidarity with, it was as if for that particular day, I was for me to contribute to the University of Tennessee was to say that I'm with you. But similarly, like with the, with the Ukrainians, we wanted to be able to say, I'm a citizen, if you will. And I almost wonder if that's where we're looking for that sort of homogenization to occur. And we haven't done enough of that. Does that make sense, maybe?
There's two things in that for me. The first one is that real clarity and purpose that I think some charities miss. If you think about the response to Ukraine, it was so clear what their purpose was. And it was quite simple for people to understand. And there's also an end point to it. So at some point, the war in Ukraine is going to be over. At some point, Ukraine's economy and society will recover. It may be decades into the future, but at some point it will get there and we'll see the end. And I think charities get hung up on this idea that they need to exist forever, for all eternity. Actually, they need to exist until their purpose is met. And they should do everything they can to meet that purpose.
Yeah.
And I think when a charity has that as their... Or even a cause, it doesn't have to be a charity, any kind of contribution society has that clarity, it makes it much easier for people to engage with. The second thing then is, the Airbnb example. People have complete control there. As a consumer of Airbnb, I'm going to buy this, room, this unit, this property for a week, and it's going to be for this person, and I've paid my bit. What a beautiful... A, the amount of control they've got, B, the amount of connection they've got to the thing that they've purchased, and no doubt they'd find a way of actually communicating with the people who have used that as well. So it's that whole connection to the cause and to the beneficiary, again, that I think that we as charities put ourselves in the middle of. It becomes about us. You've given us money. This is what we've done with that money. And actually, it should be more about us being a mediator for something to happen. And it's actually about the donor having done that thing rather than about us as a charity. And I think that's the two things I pull out of those examples, I'd say.
David, is that why that worked? Because I've been fascinated by that and I had not thought about that. David, is that why that worked? Is because with the Airbnb, it actually gave us an address to send the money to and we knew exactly where that money was going? Is that what it was?
Yeah, why not? And supporters have been fighting for control and visibility over their donations for decades. What better way to do it?
How proximate can you get, right? We've been talking about proximity. How closer to, while I'm still on the ground here in York, Pennsylvania, by having an address, no charity could give me an address like Airbnb could. I mean, Airbnb could show me a photograph of the living room,
Yeah.
I mean, it was so real. I had never, David, thought about that.
It was completely authentic.
Yeah.
That's the authenticity of it. And I think that's where, we're currently launching our Christmas campaign. And for the first time, we're using the voice of a child in terms of this is why children like me need the help that Starlight can provide. And I think, David touches on that in what he's just said in terms of removing self. As a charity, you're a group of people that are trying to encourage one group of people to help another group of people or a cause. And I think we get too caught up in being that rather than encouraging that group of people to engage with that group of people. You are just the conduit.
Mm-hmm. We actually had a conversation, Sam, about that very letter. You know, this girl had written this letter that goes out to our supporters, and there was a couple of bits in it that, from a brand perspective, weren't right. So there was a part where she wrote the words "aha," and there was a bit where she drew an emoji using sort of semicolons and a parenthesis, and there was a conversation. It was only a very short one. It was a conversation of, oh, we need to be consistent. We need to either do that, or use proper emojis. And I went, no, because that's not what she wrote. That's not what she said. So we need to try and keep it as authentic as possible, because otherwise it just becomes Starlight rather than the, you know, the actual person that's going to benefit. So, you know, it's just a very simple example, but that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, you guys have got me. We could probably just sit on that. You got me really thinking about the way, because the other fascinating thing about the Airbnb sort of Ukraine response in terms of charitable giving is also that it's just purely an adaptive. It's a complex system that sort of just self adapts. It just sort of finds the way to sort of get there. And I think going back to David, I think it was your reference to the Industrial Revolution, you know, a lot of our fundraising practices are designed, built on these very linear machine-like systems that sort of assume a certain degree of efficiency and predictability and control. That in a hyper-connected sort of complex world, when the generosity from individuals here in the there in the UK and here in the US want to get to the Ukraine, in a hyper-connected world, it's just going to find the most, you know, it's going to find the fastest way to do that. And that's what a complex system does. And I don't know that when we're at a conference, you know, when we're at a, you know, when we're walking around the exhibit hall at a conference, I don't know that there's really a lot of us that are sort of thinking like complex systems. I think we're thinking like we're running machines. I think we're all master technicians at fundraising. And I don't know that sort of fits the bill anymore.
I love that analogy of finding the fastest route. You know, you think about a lightning strike, it goes to ground the quickest way possible. And that's exactly what would happen in an emergency. The solutions that, you know, Ukraine needed, they found them quickly. And if we as organizations could provide that but are slow to respond because of our leadership, our structure, our beliefs, our processes, that's going to prevent us making the impact in society that we want to make. I think it's a really great point.
And David, I don't know if you guys are familiar with this, but that's exactly what happened at the university when Tennessee beat Alabama. There was this extraordinary sort of reaction to the idea that that Tennessee wanted the goalpost paid for, and something was able to be organized in a matter of days. It's kind of a fascinating thought. Guys, we lose our listeners. We lose our listeners at about 45, 50 minutes in, which is exactly where we're at. Before we could keep going, and David, you know this because I've pointed this out a couple of times. You're more than welcome back, as Sam has come back and had these thought-provoking conversations with me. But I wanted to sort of wrap up with the opportunity for you guys to sort of point out how people can reach out to you. They're interested in Starlight, or perhaps just interested in reaching out to each of you individually and just continuing this conversation. How would you like them to do that?
For me, you're more than welcome to try and find me on LinkedIn. David Amos Reeves, it's a relatively unique name. I should probably hope it's one of the few in the world since it's a new one for me. Or you can actually email me, david.amosreeves@starlight.org.uk, and I'm more than happy to have conversations with your listeners.
And for me, LinkedIn again, Samuel Butler, and sam.butler@starlight.org.uk. And likewise, happy to continue the conversation.
Sam and David, it's certainly been a pleasure. I'm delighted that Sam, you made the introduction. You took the back seat there for a little while, so we appreciate that. You let me and David pass the ball back and forth. And it's been a great conversation. You're certainly both always welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jason.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.